Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated January 17, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's first story, Top of the Fold, Lawsuit Has Woz in the Hot Seat Again, by Jason DeBruin. This story comes to you from Raleigh. A lawsuit filed against the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services might prove to be the last straw for the public image of Aldana Woz, whose short career as Secretary of the Department has been mired in controversy. Medical providers filed a suit on January 16th against DHHS for damages their practice suffered under NCTRACS, the system by which the state processes Medicaid claims. Since its rollout on July 1st, providers have complained of missed, delayed, or incorrect payments. Computer Sciences Corporation, CSC, the vendor that built NCTRACS, SLI Global Solutions, which tested NCTRACS, and Maximus Consulting Services, which provided an independent review, are also named as defendants. NCTRACS was supposed to be a model of healthcare information technology that would seamlessly and efficiently process and pay billions of dollars of claims each year. Instead, NCTRACS has been a disaster, inflicting millions of dollars in damages upon North Carolina's Medicaid providers, according to the complaint filed in Wake County Superior Court. Aldana Woz, Secretary of Department of Health and Human Services, was one of Governor Pat McCrory's first appointments. She holds a degree in medicine but has not had much health policy experience. She first crossed medical providers last spring when she and McCrory unveiled their initial plan for Medicaid reform titled The Partnership for a Healthy North Carolina. Under the plan, the state would contract with private entities for management of the Medicaid population, a system providers and patient advocates feared would restrict access to care as these private entities would stand to gain financially by decreasing reimbursements. Under this model, the state would pay the private entity a set amount, and every dollar not spent on Medicaid would be a dollar it keeps. Add that Woz entered a political climate in which Medicaid supporters were already skeptical. The Republican-led legislature had rejected a Medicaid expansion and did not establish a state-run health insurance exchange. This resulted in lower federal Medicaid funding and sent people to the federally run healthcare.gov to buy new insurance plans available because of the Affordable Care Act. Although Woz was technically not involved with either of these decisions, Woz, as a member of McCrory's cabinet, was seen as being in step with those policies. During 2013, the department's focus has been on reforming Medicaid, improving statewide delivery of mental health and substance abuse services, and increasing efficiency in our day-to-day operations, says a DHH spokesperson. As the secretary told legislatures, she intends to keep those items at the top of her agenda in 2014. Medicaid providers who see mental health patients have had their problems as well. Under a model adopted throughout the state last year, providers of mental and behavioral health care no longer deal directly with the state, but with what are called managed care organizations, also known as MCOs. Patient and provider advocates say DHHS has done little to oversee how these MCOs are treating providers, and these providers have had to go to the courts just to keep their existing Medicaid contracts. Last summer, NCTRACS launched, bringing a fresh round of criticism. It even led Nash OBGYN Associates in Rocky Mount to stop seeing new Medicaid patients. This has proven to be a very challenging time for our practice and has consumed an enormous amount of our practice administrator and staff's time, wrote the doctors of Nash OBGYN to DHHS. We have always felt strongly about serving all of the women in our community and the surrounding areas. This was not a decision easily made, but we feel we have no other choice. State Auditor Beth Wood warned in the spring that the system wasn't ready to launch, and then in the fall found some 3,200 defects with NC Tracks. Lawmakers grilled WAS and her department after the audit's release, specifically asking why WAS took the system live despite the warnings. WAS told legislatures that her department had not received warnings, leading Wood to take a direct line at WAS by letting legislatures know that WAS wasn't being completely truthful. There were a couple of things that were said that were incorrect information, Wood told the Joint Program Evaluation Oversight Committee, a committee of state lawmakers, after WAS claimed she had not been warned about the system. Finally, a few weeks ago, the department sent nearly 50,000 Medicaid cards for children to the wrong recipients, leading state lawmakers and the Legislative Black Caucus to call for WAS's resignation. On January 14th, WAS apologized. So far, the McCrory administration has supported WAS. Neither WAS nor DHHS offered a comment for this article by deadline. In the world of politics, members of the executive cabinet may not be affected by calls from the opposing party to resign. But things change once lawyers get involved, especially when a state agency is a defendant in a lawsuit. Of course, the litigation must still play out, a process that could take 2 years or longer, but to date, DHHS under WAS's leadership has seemed to garner more criticism than praise. Next up, this week's lead story, The Jobs Man, dissecting the vision of the career CEO who is leading the charge to spur economic activity in North Carolina, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. The newly minted job czar for North Carolina is not shy talking about how he wanted to head the state's public-private economic development partnership. 69-year-old Richard Dick Lindenmuth says when he first met with Commerce Secretary Sharon Decker at Cafe Carolina in Cameron Village last fall to discuss the job, she said she wasn't looking for a politician. "Well, that's me," he recalls saying. "My father, I think, worked for Eisenhower's campaign, but I don't think I've ever contributed to a political campaign." But Lindenmuth's task after a brief honeymoon of well wishes is nothing short of daunting. He has to transfer state employees and establish new goals. He has to work with business targets and his board to present the Tar Heel State as one of the most progressive venues in the nation. And he has to do all of that in front of the watchful eyes of the partnership's detractors, who believe the new model will leave North Carolinians in the dark because of the perceived secrecy. But Lindenmuth is far from deterred. He says he is ready. In the 10 days since Richard Dick Lindenmuth was appointed interim CEO of the new Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, he has been heeding his own advice from his book released in November. Listen, and listen carefully. He's listened to top executives of MetLife seeking help recruiting more engineers for their new technology campus in Cary. He's listened to the Commerce Department staff, some of whom will transition to the partnership this summer, who feel compelled to test his language skills. Lindenmuth is fluent in Italian and French. "Do not stop asking just because you think you have the answers," he writes in The Outside the Box Executive, a book he self-published in November. In an interview with Triangle Business Journal, Lindenmuth says he knows the transition from a state government-run agency into a public-private partnership will be a huge change in the way North Carolina has recruited business and jobs in the past, and a lot of people are still skeptical. "Communicating about change is never easy because everybody has their own expectation of what it means," he says. "Until they understand what it means for the individual, it's very hard to be enthusiastic about it." Lindenmuth has built an entire career around instituting change and being the new guy brought in by an investor group or board of directors seeking help for a company in crisis. He helped institute change as an interim executive at nearly a dozen companies across the country. So far, he says, he was the CEO during the phased shutdown of the metal components manufacturer Amcast Industrial Corporation, and he was in charge of the turnaround of what is now Quantigy Recording Solutions, a manufacturer of audio tape still used in aircraft black boxes and other audio products. Early in his career at the Singer Sewing Machine Company, he gained international experience when the company sent him to the Middle East and Africa to help turn around declining sales there. Some guy in New York didn't want to go, so they said, "Send Lindenmuth. He'll go anywhere." I got pretty used to it, and it became fun. Sometimes change in a company he's been assigned has meant employee layoffs. Sometimes it has meant elimination of a product a company has been producing since it started. Sometimes that has meant bankruptcy or sale of the company. But adding value in a short period of time was always the end goal, he says. I like change management, he says. I'm relatively good at it. In the economic development field, Lindenmuth will again assume the role of the new guy, since he has never held a government job or any position with an economic development agency before. It will be perhaps his most challenging assignment yet. It's been nearly 28 years since Lindenmuth has ever worked in North Carolina. He was first sent to Raleigh in 1981 to help lead the ITT Business and Consumer Communications Group through rapid deregulation, a job that kept his full attention for about 5 years. But it was the urging of Terry Sanford, the former North Carolina governor, U.S. Senator, and president of Duke University, who was serving on ITT's board of directors at the time, that Lindenmuth, a native of Philadelphia, decided to make Raleigh his family's home. Even though I worked in Hong Kong, Thailand, Indonesia, and elsewhere, and have lived in a number of places, I have never been anywhere as great as North Carolina. Continuing on inside from the front cover, Raleigh's Waste Industries names new COO, by Lauren K. Onisores, from Raleigh. Waste Industries, a Raleigh-based solid waste and recycling collection company, has a new operations chief. Solid waste operations expert Greg Yorston has been appointed the company's chief operating officer, a role in which he'll direct company-wide operations across the southeastern United States and manage all non-accounting processes and procedures for all branches within the Waste Industries footprint. Waste Industries currently employs 2,000 employees, and CEO Vin Poole tells us that the company has been growing 6-9% a year, crediting that growth to a combination of direct sales, new commercial and residential customers, and new contracts with municipalities that have chosen to privatize solid waste and recycling efforts. But that's not the only impetus behind that growth. We also acquire between 18 and 24 smaller companies per year, typically when the owners are ready to retire, he adds. Expectations are high for Waste Industries, which recorded about $462 million in revenue in 2012. But Poole says Yorston is up to the challenge. Formerly the firm's senior vice president of operations, Yorston has worked with the company's former COO, Harry Hobbitz, to execute the transition. Hobbitz retired on December 31, 2013. Poole says Horston brings a wide array of skills and is a perfect fit to build upon the operational excellence Waste Industries is known for. Yorston is just the third person to hold the COO position since the company was founded in 1970. This week's column of Commercial and Residential Real Estate by Amanda Hoyle lists Lifetime Fitness Plans, a mega gym. Former North Raleigh driving range site purchased for $5 million. The Lifetime Fitness Club has finalized its purchase of 26 acres in North Raleigh, where it plans to build a mega gym complex at the former Falls of Neuse driving range property. An affiliate of Lifetime has paid $5 million for the driving range property, according to Wake County records, which is about a 58% premium over its $3.16 million tax revenue. The property is within the watershed area of Falls Lake, but Lifetime's plan to capture and slowly pump water off the site was enough to appease Raleigh city leaders, who approved the plans for the project in June. Lifetime had originally submitted a rezoning request for the Falls of Neuse Driving Range site in fall 2012, which we reported on in October 2012. Chan Hansen, Minnesota-based Lifetime plans to build a 112,000-square-foot structure with a 3,000-square-foot cabana. Lifetime has also purchased an additional 2.5 acres next to the site to allow additional access to the club from Walton Commons Drive. The private members-only health club would have many of the same amenities as a Lifetime fitness club that opened on Regency Park in Cary in 2006. Indoor and outdoor swimming pools, a gymnasium, a fitness center, a restaurant, a child care center, a salon, and a spa. Lifetime Fitness has three other smaller locations in the Triangle on Six Forks Road, at Plantation Point Shopping Center off Capitol Boulevard, and in North Raleigh and in Apex. Amanda also writes about a local builder who paid $6 million for a North Raleigh infill site. A Raleigh home building company has bought one of the last big pieces of undeveloped land along Ray Road in North Raleigh, a nearly 30-acre site that the Willie Chavis family has lived on for decades. A subsidiary of Royal Oaks Homes of Raleigh, called Stonehenge Manor Developers, LLC, paid $5.9 million for the land that was owned by four of the Chavis descendants, according to Wake County Deeds records, or about 200,253 per acre. The property is located at the southwest corner of the intersection of Ray Road and Howard Road in North Raleigh. Royal Oaks is planning to build a new home neighborhood with 82 home sites and three open space lots, according to a site plan submitted to Raleigh City Planners in July. Each of the homes will average 3,100 square feet, which is comparable to the homes built in the adjacent Stonehenge Park subdivision in 2011 and in 2012 by another Raleigh home building company, Homes by Dickerson. Homes sold at Stonehenge Park were priced in the $500,000 range and have since sold out. City plans also show that Royal Oaks Stonehenge Manor neighborhood will have a street system that filters into the existing streets through Stonehenge Park, the Bembridge neighborhood that was built in the mid-1990s, and the Hampton Oaks neighborhood that was built in the 1980s. Royal Oaks President Rich Van Tassel was not immediately available for further details about the project. Also this week, by the numbers, Triangle Home Owners in 2013 had a much easier time finding a strong buyer pool for home listings than in any of the past 5 years, and that trend is expected to continue in 2014. 29,469 closed sales, an increase of 23.5% year over change. $198,000 medium sales price, that's up 4.2%. $236,756 was the average sale price, that's up by 4.5%. And a total dollar volume in millions was $6,970, that's up 29.1%. The percent of original list price received was 95.4%, up 1.9%. And the only decrease was the days on market until sales. That number was 100, and that's a decrease of 16%. This week's column from Lauren Onisorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. Her article leads with PowerSecure sells subsidiary to Anvua. Wake Forest clean tech company PowerSecure sold its subsidiary, Innovative Electronic Solutions Lighting, IESL, to Morrisville-based Anuva Services. The move, according to a securities filing, is part of PowerSecure's previously announced restructuring efforts. Company spokesperson John Bluth says the deal impacts fewer than 30 employees and that the majority of those workers have been divided between Anuva and PowerSecure with a very few job casualties. He also points out that separately, PowerSecure has hired more than 100 people in the past year. The bulk of the deal involved equipment and not personnel, he says. IESL was overlapping with a recent PowerSecure acquisition, Solias Lighting, Bluth says, leading to the decision to restructure. PowerSecure experts expects the restructuring to result in a total charge of between $4 million and $6 million during the fourth quarter of 2013 and the first quarter of, the fourth quarter of 2013 and the first quarter of 2014. For Anuva, the deal adds an LED lighting manufacturing facility in Morrisville and will dramatically increase the firm's capability, says Anuva CEO Vinu Patel in a release. How Southeast expansion will help us build a regional niche market as well as stimulate jobs and the economy in the greater Research Triangle Park area, Patel says. Anuva has facilities in both Morrisville and West Melbourne, Florida, and per the release will soon be hiring in both locations. Anuva provides design, manufacturing, repair, and logistics solutions to customers in a broad array of industries. On this week's Technology Watch, Lauren Onisorg tells us that Patent King IBM is a champion at innovation. IBM topped the patent list for the 21st consecutive year with a record-setting 6,809 patents in 2012. Those inventions cover a broad range from IBM's cognitive Watson to cloud computing, and the final total exceeds the combined totals of Amazon, Google, EMC, HP, Intel, Oracle, and Symantec, something Big Blue credits to more than 8,000 IBM inventors in 47 different states and 41 countries. IBM also invests about $6 billion a year in research and development. Samsung, Canon, Sony, and Microsoft round out the top five. Christopher Padilla, Vice President of Governmental Programs at IBM, blogs about the news today, writing that it is critical the nation continue to protect the patent system to encourage the innovation that drive our economy. Additionally, he writes that IBM is a strong supporter of legislative action that might protect companies from what he deems to be unfair patent claims, but it doesn't support action that harms the inability to innovate. One such proposal to expand the covered business method patent proceeding at the United States Patent and Trademark Office is to cover software, he writes. This proposal would directly threaten the very innovations that boost our economy, like IBM Watson, as well as other software inventions important for U.S. economic growth. He says the proposal discriminates against one area of technology and will diminish U.S. competitiveness by devaluing a class of patents. The Raleigh startup Valencell Pens partnership with LG Electronics. The Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas set the stage for a big announcement from Raleigh startup Valencell, a partnership with LG Electronics. CEO Steve LaBeouf had told us to expect a partnership disclosure, prompting us to include Valencell on our startups to watch list for 2014. Specifically, Valencell's biometric sensor technology has been licensed to LG for a new Bluetooth heart rate monitoring earphone. The product will be able to measure a user's heart rate, distance, and speed, as well as calorie burned. The user can then use a mobile app to keep track of that information. That's the third big partnership for Valencell after Skrushy and iRiver, but perhaps the most familiar to U.S. consumers. LG, which creates electronic devices such as 3D televisions and smartphones, is a Korean electronic giant with U.S. headquarters in New Jersey. In search of local success, local techs parade at the Consumer Electronics Show. What do Mariah Mineuse, Nick Cannon, Kristen Bell, 50 Cent, and Raleigh entrepreneur and Valencell CEO Steve LaBeouf have in common? Well, they all appeared in Las Vegas for the Consumer Electronics Show. Here are the Triangle area tech entities that displayed their wares. Alco Electronics, a Raleigh-based company in operation for 20 years dedicated to creating exciting new audio and video products that make life more enjoyable. Carry Audio Design, an Apex-based company with a passion for the finest reproduction of music and cinema that develops audio and video products. Drycase, a Wilmington-based startup creating waterproof cases for your cell phones and tablets. The case's vacuum seal allows you to take photos underwater and dive 100 feet with your iPhone. I Say So, a Raleigh company developing mobile and web-based technology that helps seniors live independently. Families are connected to the system and are alerted when their senior needs help. Lenovo, the Chinese electronics giant, has its America's headquarters in Morrisville and has a manufacturing line in Whitsitt. Lenovo is trying to dominate in mobile devices as well. Neusoft America, the Morrisville-based American offshoot of Chinese IT services provider Neusoft. NSF Assist Nanosystems Center at NCSU. This university program is developing low-power, wearable devices that operate off the energy your body creates. Telit Wireless Solutions, a Morrisville firm that offers cellular and short-range modules. And lastly but not least, Valencel, a Raleigh sensor technology firm that just announced a partnership with LG Electronics on headphones. This week's column on healthcare and higher education is written by Jason DeBruin. In his subcolumn, He Said It, Fred Eshelman, who serves on the UNC Board of Governors, is quoted, "I can't understand this." UNC Board of Governors member Fred Eshelman, in response to a report that shows 109 professorships throughout the UNC system are being held up because the state has not matched what private donors have given. Fundraising groups from the state's universities have raised $61 million for distinguished professors, but can't use that money until the state kicks in its promised matching grants of $34 million, essentially holding 109 professorships hostage. Through the University of North Carolina system, individual universities raise money for endowed professorships. These are typically either $500,000 or $1 million each, with the investment earnings off the endowment going to fund distinguished professorships. However, the UNC system has a policy that the state will match roughly $1 per every $2 raised from private donors before it establishes the professorship. Because the state has not given its share of $34 million, the universities cannot establish the distinguished positions. In addition, UNC System President Tom Ross has said that he can't, in good conscience, tell potential donors that their funds will be matched by the state. "We've stopped fundraising because we haven't made good on that promise," Ross said in a recent Board of Governors meeting. The board oversees the entire public university system, which includes UNC Chapel Hill and NC State University. Next up, college degree costs at NC universities continue to rise. Spending per conferred degree increased at North Carolina's public universities after decreasing every year since 2007 and 8. Across all of the state's public universities, the education and related spending per degree conferred increased 2% to $67,853 in 2012 and 13. While that figure is up, university officials are quick to point out that it's still well below the $75,688 spent per degree in 2007 and 8. The figure is measured by calculating all operational costs divided by how many degrees were conferred. Costs do not include capital costs, but do combine state appropriations and total tuition collected. Since 2007 and 8, degrees conferred have increased 20% to 50,667. UNC System President Tom Ross says there are various factors that cause the figure to fluctuate. One of the biggest factors in 2012 and 13 was that the university system unfroze pay for the first time in years. Furthermore, Ross says that simply reducing spending is not necessarily the goal. "We want to be as efficient as possible as long as we don't reduce quality," he says. And UNC systems are asking for another $94 million from taxpayers for the 2013-14 school year. The additional appropriations would allow the universities to reduce tuition to out-of-state students, including military and veterans, and help recruit and retain top faculty. If granted, it would bring the overall budget for the UNC system to $2.55 billion. That's billion with a B. Also, might UNC chart separate course for its athletes? When it comes to educating high-profile athletes, Peter Hans, chairman of the board that oversees the UNC system, may have an idea that would radically change the educational landscape. At a meeting with the UNC Board of Governors, Hans said it might be time to explore a different path for student athletes. He suggested incorporating classes within the community college system or even offering different degree levels for those athletes who are not academically fit for UNC University. Though the idea would be a major shift in current educational policy, other members of the Board of Governors barely reacted to Hans' statements made at the Educational Planning Committee of the Board of Governors, which oversees the entire UNC system, a network of 17 institutions statewide, including UNC Chapel Hill and NC State University. Of course, before such a plan could be implemented, it would take broad discussion and likely take years to be fully executed. Still, the chairman's perspective carries weight, and Hans is very well liked and respected by other board members. Hans was speaking in response to an official annual report made to the UNC Board of Governors on the educational attainment of athletes. That report has several findings, including that 5 Division I UNC campuses scored a low academic progress rate, APR, an official measurement of the NCAA, and could be subject to penalties once NCAA APR requirements are in full effect in 2015 and 16. And Don Curry's column of Money and Small Business covers the Outer Banks Brewery trims costs with wind power. The Outer Banks Brewery station in Killdevil Hills is known as the first wind-powered brewery in the country, according to the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Established in 2001, founders Eric Reese and Aubrey Davis envisioned an environmentally friendly brew pub. Long ago, Outer Banks visitors may remember it as the old JK's location. During the winter months, the restaurant is closed, but the brewmaster, Scott Myers, is still there working, so I was lucky he picked up the phone. Myers says the wind turbine, a BWC XL with a rotor diameter of 23 feet, it sits on a self-supported lattice tower 80 feet up, shaves about $150 to $250 off the brewery's electricity bill each month. There were other breweries buying wind power credit from us, but we are the first to be powered by a wind turbine, Meyer says. The bill is usually higher than $250 for us, so the wind turbine sets it off. You have windy months and not so windy months. Springtime, March, April, May, that's our windiest time. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy says the Outer Banks Brewing Station is one of 14 prime examples of how wind turbines spur ecotourism. Inside the restaurant, customers can view information on the turbine and the amount of energy it generates, writes Allie Brown of the Clean Energy Org blog. According to Brown, the wind turbine will offset approximately 1.2 tons of air pollution and 250 tons of greenhouse gases over its operational life. Next up, new North Carolina EcoDevo plan still lacks critical details, by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. While Governor Pat McCrory's plan to privatize the business recruiting functions of the North Carolina Department of Commerce has faced a few setbacks, leaders involved in the transition say the new private nonprofit group should be up and running by July 1. That's despite some criticism that Commerce Secretary Shannon Decker has been fast-tracking plans without proper legislative authority for the new Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. It would be great to say we've got it all figured out, but this is fairly complicated stuff, says John Lasseter, chairman of the North Carolina Economic Development Board and one of 5 interim board members chosen to lead the new private partnership. One of the main holdups, Lasseter says, is how the partnership will be financed. The partnership kickoff has also been waiting for approval of the state's new strategic plan for economic development, which will be presented to the governor on January 24th. It is expected that corporate sponsors from across the state will be able to buy membership into the organization, similar to how public and private partners contribute to Research Triangle Regional Partnership. It's how much the state will contribute and from what funding source that has been up for debate. The legislature is expected to revisit the bill when the short session begins in May. A Commerce proposal submitted to State Budget Director Art Pope in December shows that the state anticipates between $1 million and $1.5 million in savings through potential workforce reductions and other operational expenses. In the meantime, Decker on January 7th announced that Dick Lindemuth of Raleigh had been chosen as the interim chief executive of the new partnership. Lindemuth is working under a personal services contract worth $120,000 a year, and his interim role would likely become more permanent once the partnership is up and running. If the partnership is approved, North Carolina would join a list of about seven other states that have moved their business recruitment and marketing functions to public-private partnerships, including Virginia and Florida. Texas has also turned over some of its business recruitment functions to the privately funded Texas One Group. Texas Governor Rick Perry, for example, has used funds from Texas One to finance TV commercials aired in California, Illinois, New York, and Connecticut, urging business owners in those states to move to Texas. Business development is highly competitive, especially in the Southeast, but unfortunately it costs a lot of money to do that, says site selection consultant Jason Hickey of Hickey & Associates in Minneapolis. Additional funds from other sources could create new opportunities for North Carolina to be seen and be known. But some states have privatized economic development, have also faced allegations of misuse of taxpayer funds, excessive executive bonuses, and questionable claims by the public-private partnership about its impact, as detailed in the report Creating Scandals Instead of Jobs, The Failures of Privatized State Economic Development Agencies. This by the public policy watchdog agency Good Jobs First. Lindemuth says he has not reached out to any of the leadership teams of those other state public-private partnerships for advice. Why? They did it wrong, he said. That's part of this murky stuff. They moved too quickly and it became too political. Pat Corso of Pinehurst, an early adopter of the partnership plan and an interim board member alongside Lassiter, Kane Realty Corporation CEO John Kane, Lenovo executive Tom Looney, and Red Hat president and CEO Jim Whitehurst, says he is hopeful the partnership will, instead, make the state more nimble, feisty, and aggressive. That's part of how you have to play this game, he says. Sometimes in business, it's time to shake it up, and hopefully in doing so, it doesn't break the paradigm. But is it worth the risk? Yes, in my opinion, it is. This week's column of Executive Force is O'Hara Mackin. By Lauren Kayoni Swords. Move south, hire 250 people, and build a tech vibe. No problem. The past 6 months have been a blur for O'Hara Mackin, Executive Vice President and Managing Director at iPrio. Back in April, his New York-based financial technology firm made the high-profile decision to bring 250 jobs to a new Raleigh site. That decision had Mackin packing his bags and trekking south, four kids in tow. The new facility, steps away from Red Hat Tower in the newly tech-rich Raleigh downtown, opened this fall. The site does everything, says Mackin, from research to sales to account management. It even has one research area the New York headquarters doesn't have, mobile technology. But capabilities don't mean anything if you can't fill the seats. His number one priority? Hiring. It's what he was brought to Raleigh to do, and he's not shirking from the pressure. His boss tasked him with getting the first 150 employees in place by the end of 2014. In walking past the gray, dry-erase write-on walls and the collaborative cluster of desks, one can see success. As of January, the company had 145 team members in place, which I think is pretty important since in April we didn't have any, he says, and that means the potential for even more hires in 2014. But he's not just looking for technical minds, he's looking for personalities that mesh with the iPrio culture, and to do that, he has to get inside people's minds during an interview. That's why the number one question he asks applicants is what motivates them, what gets them excited. His personal answer? The markets, and probably before the markets, people we work with. I just like the capital markets, he says. Data has always excited him. It's what got him interested in the field in college. The nice thing about data and math, for the most part, is it's black and white. His pet peeve during an interview? When people come in completely unprepared, he says, they don't know what Aprio is. They don't even know what they want to do. But every job isn't for everyone. He remembers the worst job interview he participated in, though he won't name the firm. The person I was meeting with was 45 minutes late, he says, adding that he quickly learned that was the wrong culture. But Aprio's Raleigh task isn't just hiring, it's also working on brand recognition with loud sponsorships, such as Winterfest, to ensure Raleigh knows it's here. Mackin says it's trying to be at the beginning of this technology movement, hitting Raleigh an exciting place to be. But Mackin, who runs triathlons on the state, on the side, isn't all suits and ties. Outside the office, he has a lacrosse commuting kid wrangler with a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 5-year-old. There are gymnastics classes and hockey, he says, and the activities are a good distraction. At their last home, New Jersey, it was a close family of 10 cousins doubling as playmates. The activities in Raleigh have helped ease the transition, as had the food. I've actually found some pretty good sushi here, he says. And this week's column of 9 to 5, Raleigh-based Gregory Poole Equipment Company has been selected as one of the statewide vendors for school and activity buses in North Carolina. In 2011, the company became the sole dealer and service provider of Bluebird's buses across North Carolina. Our diverse strengths and product support capabilities, combined with the quality and the safety features of Bluebird's buses, makes this an exciting opportunity for both companies as well as the state of North Carolina, says Kirk Burns, bus sales and business development manager for Gregory Poole Equipment, in a statewide release. The company has 19 locations in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. Jeff Sheehan, Senior Vice President of Duke Realty Corporation's Raleigh office, has been appointed to the North Carolina Global Transpark Authority by Governor Pat McCrory. Sheehan, who has managed Duke Realty's Raleigh business unit since 2007, fills one of two commercial real estate seats on the 20-person board. Located in Kinston, GTP is a 2,500-acre manufacturing and distribution center designed to meet the logistic needs of businesses through an intermodal transportation network anchored by a cargo airport. I look forward to my involvement with the authority and contributing to the ongoing growth at the GTP, says Sheehan. Duke Realty owns and manages more than 5.5 million square feet in the Triangle. Also, South by North Strategies Limited, a research consultancy specializing in economic and social policy based in Chapel Hill, has published its first book, Running the Numbers, a Practical Guide to Regional Economic and Social Analysis. This is published by Armonk, New York, M.E. Sharp, 2014. The book, written by the firm's principal, John Quintero, explains data concepts, sources, and methods for civic leaders, planners, profit executives, and journalists interested in understanding economic and social issues at the regional level. Also, locally owned Atlantic Tire and Service received Kerry Magazine's Maggie Award for Best Mechanic in Western Wake County. Atlantic Tire and Service's recent awards inside the Cary Chamber of Commerce's Business of the Year, Employer of the Year, and Community Service Awards, the Morrisville Chamber's Business of the Year Award, and Tire Review Magazine's Top Shop Award. Finally, MI Homes of Raleigh set an all-time record for the Raleigh division in 2013 with 422 homes sold in 16 communities in the Triangle. With a total retail value of $131 million, the average home sales price is $307,000, a 40% increase over the same period in 2012. MI Homes currently offers new homes in Raleigh, Cary, Fuquay, Vireno, Holly Springs, Clayton, Durham, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill, and plans to open two more communities in the first quarter of 2014. This week's guest column on the Viewpoint page is Mr. Frank Knapp Jr., and he is the president and chief executive of the South Carolina Small Business Chamber of Commerce. He titles his column, Renewal of Benefits, Good for Recovery. Ross Perot coined the phrase, giant sucking sound, in the presidential debates of 1998. He was talking about the jobs he predicted, correctly, that would leave the United States in search of cheaper labor if we passed NAFTA. Today's giant sucking sound is a $25 billion not going into our economy if Congress doesn't pass an extension of the federal supplemental unemployment insurance for those facing long-term joblessness due to the recession. The giant sucking sound started December 28th as 1.3 million Americans lost an average of $277 a week in these benefits while they look for work. Another 600,000 are expected to lose benefits before June. Many in Congress don't seem to be able to empathize with the unemployed struggling to survive on $277 a week. They think if these people had their benefits eliminated that they would take a lesser paying job. But even if these mostly college-educated folks previously making $50,000 or more did find these mythical 1.3 million minimum wage jobs available today, what jobs would remain for those less skilled looking for work? Critics want the renewal to be revenue neutral. No problem, just eliminate the offshore tax havens for multinational corporations that are costing us well over $25 billion a year and not benefiting taxpayers a bit. Maybe those who oppose the extension should think of the unemployed as conduits to funneling money into our local economies, including small businesses. That's where the $277 is going. It's paying the rent or mortgage, it's paying for transportation, food, clothes, and it's paying for utilities. The giant sucking sound we hear is the wind going out of our recovery. Without an extension, the economy is predicted to lose 310,000 jobs, and the country's annual growth rate will be trimmed 0.4% this quarter. The answer to this week's Business Pulse. The question was, how would you grade Pat McCrory's first-year performance as North Carolina's governor using an A through F scale? 22% of the 1,638 votes said an A. Of that same number, 17% would give him a B. The grade C would be 8%, and 17% would give him a D. And of the 1,638 total votes, 35% of that number would give Pat McCrory an F for his first year's performance as North Carolina's governor. This week's guest column is Neil Westergaard, and Mr. Westergaard is the editor of the Denver Business Journal, a Triangle Business Journal sister publication. He titles his column, Are Things Going to Pot? In the Stoner State. The nation's eyes are staring at Colorado in the wake of the first retail sales of marijuana to citizens and visitors who just want to use it for the fun of it. Legalization here is testing the theories of those who have fought for decades for the decriminalization of pot. States are watching closely to see if Colorado survives the social experiment posed by recreational pot sales or stumbles down the road to permanent slackerdom. National television talk shows are crowded with pot experts, both pro and con, who spout statistics of all manner to bolster their point. CNN's Piers Morgan had a guy on the other night that said without challenge that young people in Colorado have a 50% higher rate of marijuana consumption than other states. I don't know if that's true or not, but for one thing's for certain, this can't be good. Leaving aside the negative image sent by potential economic development prospects, legalized marijuana has the potential to alter life as we know it in Colorado. The other day, a friend of mine said she and her husband ate at a restaurant recently, and she was sure the waitress was stoned. She came back three times to ask again what they had ordered. And as one who is perpetually late for engagements, I have found a new excuse. I was stuck behind a stone driver. But the real fun comes when marijuana becomes an issue in the next presidential campaign. And it will. I'm sure of it. In a little more than a year, Americans begin in earnest the process of electing a new president. At least the news media will be serious about it then. And Colorado is likely again to be a swing state for both Republican and Democratic presidential hopefuls. We'll have nearly constant campaign trips by the candidates all out trying to woo Colorado voters to their camp. By then, however, the news media fascination with Colorado having adopted the most wide-open pot laws in the world, freer than even Amsterdam, will have thoroughly established Colorado in the minds of Americans as the stoner state. Rocky Mountain High will no longer be associated with John Denver's music. Here's the thing. The legal universe in which Colorado gave a green light to the retail purchase and possession of marijuana is based on the federal government not prosecuting federal drug laws, which still prohibit possession and use of marijuana. It's only legal in Colorado because the Obama administration's U.S. Justice Department decided, administratively, not to go after people for marijuana distribution and the sale of pot in states that have legalized it and have a process set up to regulate it. There's no guarantee that view will continue under a new administration. A change by a new president would put the millions invested by the marijuana industry here so far in jeopardy and bring the Colorado experiment with legal recreational marijuana to a grinding halt. Which is why reporters will be all over this the first time a presidential hopeful gets up in front of a microphone in Colorado. In fact, I'll predict that it will be the first question asked at the first interview of the first candidate's first visit to Colorado. If candidates are still doing interviews, that is. It's going to be a really sticky issue for Republicans. If they say they're against legal marijuana, it could cost them in Colorado, where a majority of people voted in favor of legalizing and then taxing pot heavily. Plus, there's all the local governments and schools benefiting from the tax revenue bonanza that legalized marijuana presents. If they say that they would leave Colorado alone and continue the policies of the Obama administration Justice Department, they open themselves to charges of being soft on drugs from socially conservative Republicans. Hard to be a law and order Republican and look the other way on pot. And for Democrats, it's a little easier. They can adopt a laissez-faire attitude and continue federal non-enforcement under the guise of states' rights. Few members of the Democratic Party base are going to jump ship because a candidate wants to leave potheads alone. As they say in the commercial, that's not natural. Watching it play out all will be highly entertaining. Expect more national news exposure for Colorado. None of it good. But if you're worried about job loss, try to remember the words of a wise man who once said, "There's no such thing as bad publicity." And remember to write down your order at the restaurant. This may sound like the plot out of a B-grade movie, but a train heist almost derails a store opening. Kerry retailer and former research scientist Julie Gensler says she can laugh about it now, but she didn't think it was funny when she found out that all of the furniture, fixtures, and casks that she would need to open her new Von Vass oil and vinegar shop in Kerry might have been stolen in a train robbery incident in Germany. They didn't know what was stolen, she says. It was during the violent St. Jude storm in late October that swept across Europe that train engineers abandoned in a train yard the containers carrying Gensler's handmade fixtures from a manufacturer in southern Germany and hundreds of other items bound for the United States. After the roads were cleared, the German police discovered several of the containers had been broken into. "Nothing could be moved until the investigation was done," said Gensler. It took about a week, she says, but none of her fixtures, valued at around $60,000, were damaged, and all have been delivered to her new shop in the Waverly Place Shopping Center in Cary. John Kane, founder of the running startup Race 13-1, says bootstrapping and dipping into my personal piggy bank for his venture was an education in itself. It was tough, but it's been really rewarding, and it's shown me how we can run things really cost effectively, he says. And it's getting easier as Raleigh-based Lookout Capital just awarded his company $750,000 in equity financing. He says that sum will help him create a half marathon events throughout the country, well beyond Raleigh. But that's someday. His first outside of North Carolina locale will be Greenville, South Carolina, where he hopes to establish an office by 2015. Also, the Triangle Business Journal offers hearty congratulations to Zach Charbot, founder of GoConnect and Go Realty, on his recent mention as one of the 100 most influential real estate leaders by trade publication Inman News. Charbot, who operates out of Go Realty's Cary office, was a lone Triangle representative on the list that included real estate titans such as Keller Williams, founder Gary Keller, and Margaret Kelly, CEO of RE/MAX. And kudos all around for the North Carolina State University-led institute. President Barack Obama's speech on January 15th drew more than political dignitaries. It also drew CEOs to North Carolina State University, such as Scott Wingo, CEO of Channel Advisor, who tells us, of course, he would attend. He is, after all, a proud alum. I'm proud that North Carolina State University won this, he says. Winning. It's a term used frequently by both Obama and Randy Woodson, Chancellor of North Carolina State University. That could be why Governor Pat McCrory, along with several members of his administration, were also enthusiastic. Elaine Marshall, North Carolina Secretary of State, tells TBJ that she enjoyed the speech because she agrees with Obama that there's really one way to get out of the recession, and innovation will pull it out for us, she says.
And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and a visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.
Online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.